to welcome Bill D. from Richmond.
Yeah, you gotta tilt me back a little here because you see the top of my head real good.
Can I adjust it? You right there? Can you see yourself there?
Perfect, okay. Right there.
Okay. Is that good?
Yeah, that's good. Our Father, who art in heaven. My name is Bill. I'm an alcoholic.
Bill!
My drink date is January 3rd, 1970. I've always had a group. I've always had a sponsor. Setting up my old guy, timekeeping stuff here. Come on, kick it. Oh, well, somebody will tell me. I'm a member of the Jaywalkers group down in the Richmond, Virginia area. Really, it's Bon Air. And we meet there Tuesdays and Fridays. Tuesdays, we read the big book. And Fridays is the open speaker meetings, which your group just sent a crew down to be our speakers two weeks ago.
Yes, sir.
And in case I ever need you, it's 2 quarts of Southern Comfort. I took my first drink at the age of 10, 11, around there, whenever you become an altar boy in the Catholic Church. And I was on schedule to serve a funeral mass. There were 4 other altar boys besides me. I was in 3rd grade. They were the cool guys from the 7th grade. And just before mass started, we were sitting in a little circle off the altar, and the Christian Brothers wine got passed around the circle. And we each took a little sip. Well, I took a guzzle, and it went around the circle again. I took another guzzle, probably 10 ounces altogether, like soda pop. And I qualify for being an alcoholic and a member of AA because I had an adverse reaction to the first drink. This is what happened. After the second guzzle went down, I'm a birth defect child. I had a cleft palate at birth. A lot of cleft palate kids don't live. And I was the ugly duckling in grammar school. I grew up ugly. I was fixed at the age of 15 with a lot of major plastic surgery. I was short. I was about 1.5 feet tall until I got to the 6th grade. And I sounded different. My speech was off because of the cleft palate. And these things constantly rolled around inside my head because when you're different and you're a kid, I usually get picked on and picked out and beat up and dragged through the mud and stuff. So right after the second drink, all of that head stuff went away completely, has not come back. The only time I visit it is when I'm doing this, telling my story at an open meeting, or going through the 5th step with a sponsee, or going over an 8th step list, getting ready to do 9 with a sponsee. Alcohol was a magic. I figured it was the missing part of the equation in my life. As soon as I found alcohol, I'm good. I remember the first couple of weeks, I made a decision. I used to say to myself, if I just have a little of this all the time, I'll be good. And basically that's how it was all during my drinking. Right away, I became a devout Catholic. I was in church all the time. Never to pray. To drink, get ready for the drinking. One Sunday, I served 3 masses for the same priest at my church. And I came home and kissed my mother hello, and she accused me of drinking. And I said, no, Mom, I'm an alcoholic. You have to lie about that. No, Mom. She goes, I can taste it on your breath. Go get your circumstances and go back across the street and resign from the Altar Boy Society. So I went up and got my cat. I lived as far as from here to the chair rack from the front door of the church. Went, got my surplice, went across the street, sought out the priest whose mass I had been serving, who I knew was quite drunk before we even started the first mass. And bless me, Father, for I've sinned, I drink the altar wine. And this is what he said. No praying, no none of this, no penance, no explanations, no questions, like it never happened. And he began to say the 6 a.m. Mass every day, and I began to serve the 6 a.m. Mass every day. And we played this game, who's going to get there first so we can drink before Mass starts. Now, we had called this priest in our church, three cruet priests. The cruet was the wine, like a little vinegar cruet that you use for your salads. He would send us off the altar to refill the altar wine cruet, and we kept the cruet right up with him so he could keep his chalice full. Great power of example for me. He was the first really bad drinker that I was exposed to. He died a very slow alcoholic death. He was missing in action a lot. It took up pieces of his limbs, and a lot of gossip went on about him. Drinking was never mentioned, but I knew. I knew the reasons. I knew what happened. The next important era was the high school era. At the age of 15, I had a year of surgery in and out of hospitals. And because I missed so much time from school, they would not let me repeat my junior year. So I had to leave public school and go to private school. Other way around, private school to public school. I was going to an all-boys high school for the first 3 years of high school. And when we got switched over to public school, I was sitting next to and around fully developed 16-year-old women. And at that time also, I had a very bad pornography addiction. So I was really zippy and upset and whirly, making the transition from one school to the other. So I didn't know what my identity was. So I got into playing records in the cafeteria. And the great thing about that is Mom had just come back from a European tour, junket tour, seeing this big cities in Europe. And Kennedy had been killed that week. And they hopped on a plane and came home. But what she did is she had been into record stores and bought the top five records for me, because she knew I was into records. I was playing music in the cafeteria. So I had Beatle records before anybody heard of Beatles here, a good year before the Beatles. So I had them, I was playing them in the cafeteria. Again, I put equipment together and began to play bars, play band breaks. And eventually I got out on the road with the college circuit, and I had a good 45-year run. I consider myself a pioneer in the DJ, mobile DJ business. A lot of fun, a lot of towns. I did it until 1970, drinking, well, drinking, drunk. And I don't think I ever was drinking. I was drinking to get loaded, to black out, not to feel, not to think. So the next thing that happened was I graduated from high school, and I did want to go to college, but my father offered to pay my way, and he got me into the community college, Westchester Community College, and they had a radio station that was defunct, so I got involved in that. I didn't do much homework or study. I went to classes, but I didn't study much, and I got this radio station up and running, and I'm doing the bars three nights, sometimes four nights a week. From I did not graduate from college. From at 66 through 70, I drank all the time. I was really never sober, never had a problem with drinking. Didn't try to slow down. I just drank with immunity, really. Until this one week in March, I had a bad week. I got fired from the radio job that I was working at. I had my first car accident. And my parents asked me to move out of the house because of the drinking. I'm the oldest of six, Irish, Catholic. You don't cut down. You don't quit. You keep drinking, but less. So from March until my last drink, I was examining the way I drank and what it did to me. Somewhere around August, I got a full-time job with the phone company, which is a great place to work if you're dying. I was on the frame running in new lines and got in trouble with whiskey over the New Year's 1969-1970 time frame. And I had a New Year's Eve party for everybody that I hadn't seen in 6 months. And they all were druggers, but they brought me a cord from my bar. My bar at that time was the floor of my bathroom. I didn't want to break anything or fall down. And from the beginning of the party, which was, I think it was a Wednesday night that year, until Saturday morning, I drank almost 30 quarts of whiskey. And doctors have told me, once you get saturated, it's just spillage. I hadn't eaten. I had stopped eating about a month before my last drink. So I didn't have any food or pots and pans or dishes or forks, and none of that stuff. So my cabinets up over the sink in my kitchen. I was in a palatial one-room apartment, about the size of the kitchen. It depended which way I was facing, what room I was in. And I put my stereo up in these cabinets. And Led Zeppelin II was new. Remember that album? I had a copy of that album that skipped for about 4 days. Hold on it. 2 days of that. Way down. 10 hours of that. Everybody in the building thought I was dead. Somebody from upstairs came down and read the name off my door and called everybody in the phone book with my last name. And they found my sister and she put a crew together and they came over and they broke in. When I came to and saw them in my room, well, in my apartment, but it was a room, I knew the secret was out. And I knew that I was done with the drinking. It was like an inner knowing. Nobody said, hey, you're done with the drinking. It was like an inner thing. And I haven't had a drink since that thought. They took me back to my parents' home and they used the old fashioned Dublin cure. They kept you awake for 24 hours. And then they let you sleep for 24 hours. And then my father took me back to my apartment and shook my hand. He goes, I don't know anything about this drinking thing. You're on your own. So I remembered I had a job. So I went back to work and they had a big meeting about me and where have I been? And I told them I've been sitting on the floor of my apartment drinking quarts. And the fourth liner put me on final warning. He said, you got yourself into this. You're going to have to get yourself out of this. Coming out of that meeting, I met Tipsy, my union delegate. Now, Tipsy was about 5 foot everything. 5 foot tall, 5 foot wide, 5 foot front to back, weighed about 600 pounds. He was very drunk at 8 o'clock in the morning, so drunk that he was already leaning against stuff. And he said to me, I'm your union delegate, and if you try to do something about your drinking, I can protect your job. And I said that really quickly, because it took him about a half hour to say that, because he had this labored breathing, and his girth was crushed. Well, if you used his belt buckle like it was an equator, once he started drinking, he would tilt. And his belt buckle would be out in front of his mouth, and huge, and he couldn't breathe, and he couldn't talk. He got a lot of guys to their first meeting. He died drunk on the streets of White Plains, in my town. Tipsy gave me the bent up corner of an envelope with a 202 phone number written on it, said, this guy's name is George, call him, he knows about drinking. So I went back across the hall and passed my my boss, and I said, I'm calling George. He goes, yeah, we know about George, call George. So I went and got my ladder, which the wire frames were shelves that were probably two stories high in this room. And these ladders were connected to the outside of the shelves, and you climbed up on the shelf to the proper cable and pair for the phone to install the dial tone and the billing number. And you put your cones around the ladder so nobody comes along and takes the ladder while you're up on the ladder. And I got up there and I plugged in and I called this number, and a lady answered the phone and said, is this Bill? Yes. I was very good at that long sentence that I just said. Yes. I had broken thinking. I couldn't get anything in my head. If you said something to me, I didn't hear you, it would go in and get up on the screen, and I would read the screen, then I'd be able to answer your question. I had very MOCUS broken thinking. MOCUS is a New York word. You can find it in the dictionary anywhere. So George said, are you on a ladder? Yes. Do you have your cones around the bottom of the ladder? Yes. I'm looking, checking. He goes, great, because 10 years ago, I was in that building on my ladder on that floor, calling AA on the ladder like you're doing now. And my foreman was at the bottom of the ladder with two police waiting for me to be done, so when I came down from the ladder, they could arrest me because I had punched my foreman in the bar across the street. Zzz, and he spoke for like 35, 40 minutes, nonstop, no breathing. And he talked about blackouts, he talked about hangovers, he talked about running out of booze, the fear of not having enough the next time I drank. The only thing that George Ed spoke about was his wife kept finding his booze. So I had been living alone my whole life. I didn't have that problem. But everything else, spot on. Then he got me talking about the cool stuff that I did at the phone company at work. We had this meter that read the bells on your phones out on your phone at the house. And we dial the last four numbers of your phone bill, and the meter would tell us how many phones were on your line. You got one free one. If there was more than one, we would change your records and bill you more money for the extra phones. Well, I didn't use it for any of that. These two lines, you could call people on both of them, hook them together, and then ring their phones. And I would put inappropriate people together who should never be talking to each other, like a hooker and a priest. Ring both their phones, and they both think they're being called, and they're talking back, and when one figures out they're, and they both think. Did this all day. So right in the middle of me explaining this part of my tomfoolery at work, George said, stop, that's nothing. I lost a telephone pole. He goes, yep, a 65-foot telephone pole was going to be cut in half at the site. a cable well, you know, that big circle that gets towed behind the cherry picker, and the cherry picker, 102 feet of Western Electric equipment, never recovered. My immediate thought was, this guy's cooler than me. I got to listen to this guy. Whatever he says, I'm going to do. And at the end of our conversation, he said, I know some people right near you who can probably get you into AA. And that's how it was in those days. You couldn't just walk in and get your coffee, be here, or have a sheet. You know. You had to be brought to the meeting by somebody who was a member of the meeting. So Saturday morning, I got a call from Screamin' Ed from the White Plains group. And Screamin' Ed screamed because he couldn't hear. So he had to talk very loud. And he asked me three questions. He says, is this Bill? Yes, I got that one right. Are you having a problem with drinking? I had never heard it put that way. Yes. And I didn't need to wait for it to go on the screen for me to read it to say back. I got one right in. And he said, do you know where the Sherwood Diner is? Yes. I'll meet you there in an hour. Click. So I don't know what an alcoholic looks like. And I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to know this Ed guy. And I walk in the front door of the diner Saturday morning about 8 o'clock. And the diner's jumping, packed. How am I going to know this guy? And I hear from over here, hey, over here. Get over here. So I go right over and sat down next to him. And I said, how did you know? He said, sit down and stay seated. Well, I knew how did you know and sit down didn't go together. So I sat down. And Ed told me his story. A lot of drinking, a lot of blackouts, a lot of trouble, terrible, terrible, bad. And he had a young guy with him who was the youngest AA member in the area. He was 13 years older than me. His name was Terry. And they both told me their stories. And at the end of breakfast, I tried to pay for my breakfast. No, we got this. Let me leave a tip. No, we got this. Here's what we're going to do. You pay the check of the guy that you take to the meeting, like I'm going to take you tonight. So trust me, it would have been much better if I bought my own breakfast that day. So walking into the meeting, they walked me right up front. Like, Billy, you know I always sit up front. And you know all about it. You've heard me tell this before. And they walked me right up to Vinny. Now, Vinny was 260, a construction worker. In shape, and he got right up in my face here, and he said, you're not going to drink, and if you have a drink, I'll find out about it. I knew I wasn't going to drink anywhere near Vinny. And that's the toughest he was with me. He said, come on, took me back to the coffee urn, kind of like the one you have, but the big diner size with the glass tube that shows you how much coffee is in the thing. And he took like a real cup. This is great to see real cups at the meetings. Been a long time since I've seen this. Cheers. He says, first you put the cup under the urn, you put about half a cup of coffee in there, and you put maybe a splash of milk, you put the first sugar in, and you get stirred around, get it all going, and then you put the second sugar in. You got that? Yes. You think you can remember that? Yes. Comma. Parenthesis. This sentence is where I commit myself to being in AA. Because he asked me, you're going to get my coffee. Everywhere we go, you get my coffee. Are you willing to do that? Yeah, I can do that. Good. Go sit down. And that's how it started. The first 16, 18 months, we went everywhere. I sat behind him in his car. He never used rearview mirror for traffic. He used it for maintaining eye contact with me in the back. It's an ongoing quiz. How much did you eat today? How much coffee have you had? And I was a new guy for about 18 months, 20 months, because all the newer people would come for 2 or 3 weeks and then they'd hear about the not drinking. And they'd be gone. We'd never see them again. I was the only one there going all the time, going to the meetings, sitting up front, getting Vinny's coffee, being pointed out by other members that I was the new guy in the meetings. I've been through the steps 5 different times, once every 5 years, the first 25 years I'm sober. And I would get stuck somewhere after 5 or somewhere in 7, depending on how much the sponsor that I had chosen had done themselves. And then I relocated to the West Coast and I met a sponsor, Forrest, who is the other side of AA, the Dr. Bob side, the Akron side, Western version of AA. And his thing was, we have the battle cry in our sponsorship tree. It's all, everything, thorough and complete. Yes, you're sober a long time. Yes, you're 12 years sober longer than me. Yes, you've done a good job. Yes, you've done a lot of work on yourself, but it's not complete and it's not thorough. We're going to go through and clean all this up. And I did a written 4th step for him, and reading the 5th step to him, he made a list of my defects of character, which he handed to me. 6th step, he had me look up all of the defects of character in a dictionary, write them out in my own hand. 7, I plugged each defect into the 7th step prayer. And the prayer became longer because of the definition, but that's how I began to work my way through the defects, because truly the defects of character is or are the alcoholism. It's not the drinking. It's not the hiding, it's the defects of character. And when I, the first 20 years in AA, I kept hearing about, oh, I'm working on lust, or I'm working on fear. It's never one defect. It's usually 6 or 7 that keep pulling at my cords until I feel them and I get a tightness just above my belly button, or I get flop sweat. Where my leg meets my hiney, you know, right in there, that zone. And then I know there's a lot of defects in character up and running. And the drill I was taught is, wait a minute, saying it out loud to myself. What is this? Out loud to myself. And immediately I can figure out in about 10 seconds the defects of character that are pulling at me. And I choose not to have these thoughts. I choose to pray. Please take away these defects of character, and how can I help? And that drill has worked for me for a long time. Forrest, when he first gave me the drill, the how can I help part, he said to me, did you ever smoke? I go, yeah, I pack 2 packs a day. He goes, you used an ashtray every time you smoked, right? Oh, no, right out the window. Good. So after the meeting, you and I are going to go out to the butt can area and pick up cigarette butts. And that's how you're going to help this group keep the church. And, we did. People stepped over us while we were picking up cigarette butts. Big, huge meeting in Danville, just south of Oakland. Let's see. When we got to the 8th step, he said to me, have you made amends to everybody on all the 8-step lists that you've written going through with other sponsors? I said, no. He goes, tell me about that. He goes, I said, well, the number one guy on my list, his name is Kevin. Every sponsor has told me, just leave him alone. Just cross him off the list. Don't worry about him. And Forrest, in his spiritual way, said, screw that. You have until midnight tomorrow to find him and make amends to him. even if you have to fly to the East Coast. You want to know why? I go, yeah. He said to me, do you know where he is? Yes. I have all his phone numbers. He's a bar owner. I got the car phone numbers. I got the two ex-wife's cell phones. I could find him. He goes, good. You go home and use all your numbers. And if you can't find him and make amends to him, you're going to New York tomorrow. And this is what you say. I've judged you. I've resented you. I envy the way you do business. I'm jealous of all the women that you're involved with. I've gossiped about you. I have fear. If any of this has gotten back to you, I hope to be forgiven. He goes, now get an index card. I'm going to say it all again to you so you can write it down. Put the index card with your money. Take that, and that's what you read from when you're making amends to him. And I got him that night. He called me back and told him. I had six of the tour speakers that travel all over the country and the world, really, speaking at conferences, representing AA, carrying the message. And Johnny is an ally, Johnny H. He's sober from 63 now, 64. He forced that same question. Do you know where he is right now? I know. I know he goes to the Bellflower meeting on Monday nights. That's tonight. He goes, do you have phone numbers for him? Yeah. Well, you can drive down there and get to the meeting, pull him out of the meeting, make amends, and then you know what to do. Click. So I drove down, found the meeting, went in, sat next to him, took a break, took him outside during the smoke break, and said the same stuff. List of defects of character that have kept me from being closer friends with you. And he said, I can feel that when the guys pick me up at the airport, the judgmentalness and the fear. You got a good sponsor. And I've seen him probably 6-7 times since I made amends to him. And it's completely different now. He would come into the room and everybody would be excited. Oh, Johnny's here. Johnny, I'm going to touch my chicken. All of that would happen, and then he'd see me, and he'd come around and sit with me until it was time for him to talk. We didn't talk, just sat. How you doing? Good. Yeah. Completely different relationship, completely different energy. And I made amends to Clancy and Ray O'Keefe and Keith Lewis, the sports announcer in LA. I can't remember his name. Anyway, I made amends to everybody on that list. And 10 step, I carry a written 10 step with me. I add to it and I take stuff off. It's an active now list, has nothing to do with the past. I admit when I'm wrong. I also, 11 step, we have a book reading group, which it should be going on now, which we cancel because I'm here. And my wife is here with me, long time sober member also. And we started with the Emmett Fox books, Sermon on the Mount. And back in the 30s, you could go hear Emmett Fox speak after the meetings because he would be giving some sort of lecture in some big hall or some big hotel downtown Manhattan. And Joel Goldsmith and M. Scott Peck and the two current guys of this era are Neil Donald Walsh, The Conversations with God books. There's a new guru about now, Eckhart Tolle. Excellent information in his readings. Just an ongoing 11-step continuing to pull apart my spirituality, and I'm with other people who are doing what I'm doing, so there's a lot of grace in the room when you do that. Mm-hmm. And let's see, this is the 12th step. I've been doing the 12 steps since I got here, and I really enjoy the fact that Zoom has saved AA. If it wasn't for Zoom, we wouldn't be here. I like the platform. Hi, Zoomers. How you doing? Everybody okay? If you need anything, call Billy. He'll get you. And I think I'm done. Thank you for bringing me up here to speak.
Oh, thank you.